This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm reading from Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002, written by Carl Safina, published by Henry Holt and Company. Last week, because she's so dangerously thin, Amelia had to take care of herself and find lots of food. As Safina writes, she strikes north, directly north, absolutely north, straight as an arrow, north. She moved into colder water in the northern Pacific, where she knew there would be squid and lots of squid. She returned from thousands of miles away to her chick, fed the chick, and as we'll see, departed immediately. But we're going to spend most of our time today on a boat making its way north and west from Tern Island to Lazen Island and on to Lisianski Island, rocking with the waves with Carl Safina and the biologists who are headed to these islands to continue their work and relieve the other biologists who've been on these islands for about 5 months. And we'll be getting more insight into the lives of some of the biologists who study the animals on these remote islands. We are still in the chapter called Moving On. After another 730 nonstop miles and 30 hours of straight flying south from the north, she again crosses French frigate shoals, Thundering Reef, and lands clumsily on Tern Island. It's March 14th. After 16 days at sea, the ground seems oddly unyielding. She still feels as though her body is gliding with gusts and swaying to swells. On legs that have grown unaccustomed to supporting her weight, she waddles over and calls to a surprisingly large chick. "That you?" To which the chick immediately responds, "Me, alive." Amelia hasn't seen her mate in weeks, but by the looks of the chick, Dad, too, has been faithful to his duties, working as hard as Amelia. Amelia has just returned from a 4,200-mile odyssey. And I'll skip some paragraphs and say that she feeds the chick and immediately walks away. She surveys the noisy island, the birds of so many species crisscrossing overhead. The younger albatross is courting and dancing with the passionate fervor of youth and no adult responsibilities. Amelia has seen it all before. She's a hard-working mom, and the youthful crowd holds no fascination for her. Amelia registers only that her chick is alive and vigorous, and this means one thing. It will need more food. In a mere 10 minutes, she's on the runway, good for takeoff. And now I'm starting in a chapter called A Small World. By March, those youngsters still alive at Tern Island have grown quite a bit. Sitting upright, the chunky chicklets look like dark, downy pineapples. This is very interesting, but I've been invited to travel a little farther along this island chain, to fabled Lazen Island. You don't turn down that kind of invitation. Lazen has been praised by Smithsonian Institution scientists as having the most remarkable biota of any island in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Ornithologist Craig Harrison has written that Lazen presents one of the finest remaining wildlife spectacles on Earth. If someone asks if you want to go, you don't say you'll check your calendar and get back to them. You immediately answer yes. Lazen has no airstrip. Access is by ship only. A week from Honolulu, even from here at French Frigate Shoals, Lazen lies days distant. Though Lazen is the second largest single island in this chain, it's small anyway, under a mile by two, just 1.4 square miles in area. Only the skimpiest skeleton crew, 3 to 6 people, is maintained there to work on seals, ducks, seabirds, and habitat restoration. Now it's time for the 5-month rotation, time to take out the survivors and bring in the fresh team. And so the bow of the U.S. scientific ship Townsend Cromwell is pointed west following the afternoon sun. I'm assigned to share a small windowless cabin with George Grigorovich, a large man with a weightlifter's build, a shaved head, and a down-curving mustache. He works the night shift in the engine room. The cabin is about 10 feet square, crowded with lockers and drawers and some storage boxes. It's a cramped, dark space, part storage unit, part prison cell. Grigorovich has no other home. 7 years in that bunk, he woofs in his husky voice. He says he doesn't like the work here anymore, doesn't like the sea, but he needs the paycheck. Says, I can't afford to live ashore. He means that financially, but it's an odd remark in a world where a lot of people with skinny paychecks manage somehow to live on land. I wonder what his comment fails to reveal. I wake in the cool blackness of the windowless cabin after a span of hours rich in dreaming. My wristwatch, the only real proof that the dream time has run out. I come into the blinding sunshine and warmth of the deck of the traveling ship, where sea and sky rim around horizon. Here's a thought. You can gaze upon any type of terra firma, from savannas to deep jungles to the highest mountains, and presume that your legs could get you there. But stand on any boat's deck or upon any shore staring seaward, and you are reminded that legs are useless on three-quarters of the Earth's surface. Whales and dolphins, descendants of quadrupeds, came to resemble fish so they could triple the size of their world. Their farewell to legs took ages, but if you're a person, to get anywhere at sea, you need a vessel. And that's what makes boats special. They're the magic carpets of most of the planet's surface. Boats carry us to visit those strangely alien creatures of the vast watery reaches where we were never meant to go, the off-limits spaces and limitless faces of the deep. A plane can get you over an ocean, but only a boat can really get you in. Boats are unmatched cheating devices. A large flying fish has flown aboard during the night and expired on deck. I pull open its big, lacy, cellophane-y, dragonfly-like wings. The first albatross, a speck on the horizon, rendered unmistakable by that wind-stiffened, bounding progress, appears briefly, then is lost among the rippled blue distances of the sea. Then for hours, sailing albatrosses are our constant companions. Soon they're joined by a frigate bird and several boobies. It's easy to imagine the solace and excitement explorers felt at the sight of increasing numbers of birds. Birds meant they were again in the company of creatures like themselves, ocean roamers who needed land occasionally, and that an island or continent must surely lie just beyond the blue horizon. An unsettled breeze has made the sea a wind-roughened, grizzled white. The boat is rocking a bit, but at the moment I find the effect soothing and pleasant. A brief exposition on swaying. Everything on a ship sways, even in superlatively benign weather. Everything hanging becomes a pendulum. Everyone uses a lot of energy just standing upright. Because of this, you eat twice as much as usual, yet maintain your weight. Putting your leg into a pair of pants while standing becomes a game of skill and peril. You shower, leaning hard against the stall or hanging on to the pipes. Cups hanging in the galley become little metronomes of the sea's rhythm. In your bunk, you must put a leg at an angle to the rest of your body to check your motion. Otherwise, you end up rolling like a log all night, rather than sleeping like one. The crew member says, I can tell who will get seasick as I watch the newcomers climb aboard. The stiff-walking ones are going to have trouble. Those who seem springy and at ease will do better. On a ship, time seems to thicken and coagulate. Events stretch out. Because of the motion of the boat, everything from traveling a flight of stairs to getting out of bed takes longer. There's hardly anywhere to go. Your options for walking are reduced to the confines within a couple of hundred feet. The inactivity has a strong soporific effect on anyone who doesn't have immediate work to do. Even attempting to read on deck usually triggers a nap. Eating and sleeping expands to dominate the days. The drone and vibration of the engine, the constant rolling, and the confinement lead to lethargy. The biologists and a couple of crew members and I have gravitated indolently to the rear deck, where we're watching the world wave by. The new biology crew for Lazen consists of two monk seal people, plus two interns whose respective jobs are to continue studies of the endangered Lazen duck and to help eradicate an introduced grass called sand burr that destroys bird nesting habitat. A second team is headed farther to Lisianski Island. A significant aspect of working on Lazen or Lisianski entails being dropped on an island for a span of several months, hundreds of miles from other people, and days from rescue in even the best conditions. It's too far to be reached by helicopter. Any rescue or evacuation would have to be done by ship. Minimum cost $80,000, so you better be dying. It's not for everyone, but some people return again and again. Petra Bertelsen, blonde, mid-30s, is sitting with a blue shirt shielding her legs from the sun. She's from Sweden, where she was a newspaper and magazine writer. She'd long been interested in ocean conservation, but she says, "I was always afraid of the sciences." Yet she took a deep breath and made a major life change, moving from Sweden to the University of Hawaii. Moving entailed selling an apartment and breaking up with my fiancé and committing to 5 years of schooling for a bachelor's in zoology. Yeah, it was a big commitment, but I've never been happier than I am out here. Here you can focus. You're always in the moment here. It's very satisfying. Brenda Becker, the lead monk seal biologist for Lazen, agrees that the commitment isn't for everyone. Tall and thin with wavy brown hair, she was raised in Nevada and studied forestry at the University of Nevada. Until, she says, I found out that forestry meant cutting down trees. So she got a dual bachelor's degree in range management and wildlife and has worked in coal mine reclamation, goose management, caribou ecology, endangered tortoise management, bighorn sheep reintroduction, and even on the U.S. congressional staff. Brenda is coming for her 12th season. Mainly, she says, I come back because I know the seals, and I want to see how their lives have progressed and unfolded. It's like soap opera, but better than TV. And for 5 months, you have beachfront property. I like the simplicity, and I'm glad we don't have a phone. I like that you can get immersed in your work, and you're surrounded by wildlife. Of course, some people decide it's not for them. Mindset is important, and it's hard on relationships. Amber Paris, a veteran here who will be working on Lisianski Island this year, adds, the flies and ants can be annoying, but the benefits are so overwhelming. The islands are just magical. You fall asleep with the sound of the terns, and you wake to the most breathtaking view of the ocean. When you walk on the beach, the footsteps are yours alone. You're doing something most people will never get a chance to do. So a few flies and ants, she shrugs, they're insignificant. Petra, with a slight challenged inner voice, says, not always just a few ants, yeah? To me, she explains, sometimes ants are everywhere. Whenever you were trying to eat or drink a cup of tea or anything, there are ants all over the place. If it's a hot night and you're sweating in your tent, you'll wake and there will be ants stuck in the sweat on your body. How many, I ask? Two, three, dozens? She says, oh, no, more. Hundreds? Oh, thousands, yeah, stuck on your body. It was pretty impressive there for a while. Another night I woke up because there was a spider on my neck. I started looking around with a flashlight and saw that there were about 20 spiders in my bed. I had to carry the spiders outside the tent one by one. I'm sure they came right back in, but I won't kill any animal. So are you a vegetarian? I started eating chicken last year. I would eat fish, but I object to fishing practices. If I knew that it was from a truly sustainable fishery with good fishing practices, I might feel differently. I just don't want to be part of any kind of mass-produced fish from large-scale fisheries. When you see big ocean-roaming fish free-swimming, they're so beautiful. You know the moonfish? That was my favorite fish to eat until I saw them alive. The two greenhorns, not counting myself, are Rebecca Woodward and Alex Wegman. Rebecca is a very young-looking 24-year-old with straight, light brown hair and lots of freckles. She's eager, a little bit nervous. Hopefully it'll look good on my resume, but I also want to see whether I can live so remotely for 5 months, unquote. Pretty soon she'll know the answer. Alex is 22 years old and on the move. In his sophomore year, he spent a month in Nicaragua studying coffee farming in a village with no electricity, no running water, no hospital. There, if your automobile breaks, you fix it by taking parts from the chicken coop. He then spent 6 months in Australia studying Aboriginal society and linguistics. He was shocked to learn that well into the 20th century, ranchers could legally shoot Aboriginal people for trespassing on land that for 40,000 years had been theirs. I'm sure Rebecca and Alex will thrive on Laysan and then be ready for new challenges elsewhere. It's an unforgettable sojourn to an unheard-of nook in the world. Somehow the people coming here have slipped the noose of the usual bind and grind. There are career downsides, though. Some people seem to get marooned. As one person observed, "This work is a paid ticket to adventure, but I've seen it put people far behind professionally. Doing this for more than a couple of years tends not to be a winning strategy if you're interested in a conventional career eventually, such as in academia or running a research program. Still, convention is not for everyone. Clouds move in, their big shadows turning the sea surface from cobalt to a mottled blue-black. Ray Boland comes aft and joins us. Born and raised in Hawaii, Ray says he's a local kid who has made it into the big field of science. He is leading a survey of the lost and discarded fishing netting hung up on the reefs, a constant danger to the wildlife. A later cruise with a larger crew of divers will return to try for the first time to systematically remove lost fishing nets from the entire island chain. So far, Ray has led localized cleanups on several islands. A black-footed albatross circumnavigates the ship on fixed wings, crossing a rainbow on the horizon. It's a good luck omen if ever there was. The bird and the surrounding sea seem right and comforting, fused and eternal. But the fleeting rainbow makes a more apt metaphor for how rapidly the sea can change. For the moment, though, I'm satisfied to realize that any day one can squeeze metaphors from clouds and ponder eternity in rainbows is a day well lived. By mid-afternoon, the birds have thinned. The sea seems again devoid and elemental. Time slows and gets syrupy. The ship's crew hammers and paints and scrapes rust. The afternoon fades. In the inactivity, the mind can wander to worries at home, but I fix my attention on the waves until I am free of thought, and the world acquires a feeling dreamier even than sleep. At sunset, some of us are on the bridge for the best view, watching the sun give itself to the sea, savoring the day's blushing afterglow. As the pilot house goes dark, the officers place transparent red plastic over the instrument screens to dim them. Outside at the rail, we look down at the glowing bioluminescence in the bow waves, tiny living things making mysterious light. We look up at Venus, Saturn, and Jupiter, arrayed in a line, ascending from the horizon, embedded in very dense stars. The boat is rocking gently, the forecast mild. The overall effect becomes hypnotic and calming. By sunrise, Laysan Island is in view. Today, the new biology crew is getting dropped off for 5 months, but for the next 5 days, the old crew will remain on the island training the newcomers. Meanwhile, the ship will leave to go farther west to Lisianski Island, where it will drop off that crew for their 5 months. When the ship returns here on its way home, it will pick up the old crew and me and take us out. We are still a few miles away, plowing toward a little bulge of land. Laysan keeps a low, sandy profile, partially clad with windswept vegetation. Black rock reefs armor the island's surfy perimeter. A central saline lake, unseen from offshore, occupies a fifth of Laysan's area, holding water much saltier than the sea. The sky over Laysan is impressively dusted with seabirds. The ocean here crawls with albatrosses. Within view, hundreds, perhaps thousands, are converging from millions of square miles. Sweep the calm ocean with your binoculars, and your eyes reveal birds almost everywhere you look. 100 or so albatrosses are bobbing in a big raft about a mile and a half offshore, as if exchanging stories about their recent journeys, but actually no person knows what they're doing. Standing at the rail looking shoreward, I say, "It's absolutely lovely." Petra responds, "I think you'll like it a lot, I think." There are rules for going ashore here, and they're unlike anything you've ever heard of. Any clothing, all clothing, must be brand new. New shoes, new socks, new shoelaces, new underwear, new hats. And everything has to be frozen for several days until the minute before you put it on for shore landing. This leads to the interesting sensation of donning frosted underwear. Jerry Leinecke of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did a pretty convincing job of explaining the rationale. Jerry has devoted 15 years to protecting and restoring these islands. He appealed to me, "Please don't think our rules are silly. It's hard to get people to understand why they need new shoes and frozen underwear. But if you're me, you realize that introduction of an alien grass may mean crashes in seabird populations or even extinction of a species, and that it will cost a decade and millions of dollars to get a type of grass off an island because somebody had seeds on their socks." His example is not hypothetical. The grass they've been trying to eradicate was probably introduced to Laysan as a seed on a scientist, perhaps on their shoelace or in their pant cuff. If it seems like a long shot that it arrived here accidentally via scientist clothing, consider this. I noticed it growing right out of the wharf in Honolulu, where the research boat docks. Leinecke continued, "Something as simple as ants hiding in cardboard boxes can change the ecology of whole islands. The ants now introduced on those islands need moisture, and one of the only moisture sources is hatchling birds. I've seen chicks get eaten alive by introduced ants." After hearing that, putting on frosted underwear seems the least I can do to help, and hidden in his comments is an interesting point. When, like Petra, you wake up with thousands of ants stuck to the sweat on your body, remember that no ants of any kind occurred naturally in Hawaii. They hitchhiked with people. I'm going to stop there. I'm reading from Carl Safina's wonderful book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002. I hope you're enjoying being in the Pacific with me. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.